Greetings and welcome, all of you critical thinkers out there who throttle up. This is a radio show and soon to be podcast that showcases critical thinking and complex problem solving. And we have wide-ranging discussions each and every weekend of how we can apply critical thinking to our daily lives, how we can understand what's going on in the lives of each and every one of us and in our families, communities, and our country. And this is a show that is designed to inform, delimit, empower, and amaze. Now, I am your host, Captain Kevin Smith, U.S. Navy retired. I'm a naval aviator and a pioneer in the field of critical thinking and other related aspects of critical thinking. One of them happens to be high-velocity reason. I'm also the originator or the father of operational decision theory, and I guess we'll talk about that at some point in the near future, because I think that's becoming more and more important as we get further into this discussion of critical thinking and complex problem solving. And exactly what do we mean by complex problem solving, and how do we go about doing such a thing? Is there a way to do it? Is there an optimum way to solve complex problems? Or do we do each and every one on an individual ad hoc basis, treating each event in our lives as unique and singular? Or do we think of it from the perspective of what we call higher order reasoning? Are there certain features and characteristics and methodologies that we can apply to any problem that we have classified or characterized as complex? Good question. Of course, I think you all know where my heart and mind sits in that discussion. Now, our tagline for the show is to accelerate beyond the ordinary, and our motto is to employ high-velocity reason to achieve high-octane performance. And our mission statement is to provide our listening audience with a relatively easy yet effective way to strengthen our power of reason through the employment of critical thinking. Our website is throttleupradio.com. That's throttleupradio.com. And the audio engineering services for the show is provided by Evergroove Studios. And they are located in Evergreen, Colorado, and that's right outside of Denver. It's actually in the foothills, so it's just west of Denver in the foothills. And they are a great group of folks and help us each and every week as we prepare this show and provide us with the highest quality audio that is possible. And they do a great job. All right. And let's see. Yes, I wanted to talk about promotional media services. So if you are like me, if you're a speaker and an author and presenter, and let's say you need to get in touch with a graphics artist. My graphics artist is quite good, and I would highly recommend her services. Now, her name is Jennifer, and she has a website. It's called standouthandouts.com, and that's standouthandouts. That's one word, standouthandouts.com. And she can turn all of your handout material into organized, branded, and powerful sales tools. She does a great job. She has a interesting product line that she calls Standout Handouts. And I would highly recommend her help if you are in the business of trying to promote yourself, your organization, your books, if you are an author, and If you have a radio show like this one, even that. Okay, so all aboard the Throttle Up Express. This is the place where all critical thinkers are welcome with open arms. And let's see, the last thing on my list here. Okay, yeah, the show is organized into three parts. Part one is typically a continuing discussion of critical thinking. Part two is our storyboard. This is a story of some form and fashion about what's going on or what's happening, or a story about an individual or a story about an idea. How was it or how is it that an idea has come to be? And then part three is our radio essay. And typically we stay to those three parts. This week, we may not get to part three. I'm not sure about that because part two is a rather lengthy discussion. And so is a prelude to this this show. So part one, we're going to be, again, talking more about critical thinking and complex problem solving. And I'm going to be talking about how we go about doing that, assuming that we need to figure out a solution for something. So, in other words, it's critical thinking in a, you know, in a focused way, which is, okay, we want to find some solution. So we have we think we have a problem, and we're trying to find a solution to it. What is the best way to go about doing that? Is there a process? Is there a method? And we get involved in that in some measure of detail. All right, so let us, that completes our introduction. Now, let us press on to part one. Okay, welcome back to part one of our show this week. And part one is a continuing discussion of critical thinking. And this is a, well, let's start off by saying that, again, let's assume that we are part of an organization, whether in our work or hypothetically, that that is a company or it is a division or a department within a company, and they are out to provide solutions to customers where a customer has a particular problem, but the solution is not necessarily obvious. And so the customer has expressed an interest in us getting involved in their problem-solving activities. And so we have this Tiger team put together. It's called a mission team. That's a fairly a common term now. It's being used within industry. So we're part of a mission team. And our job is to find out exactly what is the problem that the customer has for which we are seeking a solution. And again, problem definitions in the world of critical thinking are always pure. We never represent or even allude to the fact that there may be a solution in the problem statements. So the problem statement is a pure statement. It just clarifies to the best of our ability what the problem is. And so we are part of this team. And our job or our task or what we're trying to do is to figure out what is the problem that the customer has, and can we devise or formulate or come up with at least a proposed solution which we can then eventually prototype and try it out in a real-world operational setting with the customer participating in this effort to see if this maybe this prototype has promise, that it could very well solve the problem that the customer has. Okay, so what we're doing then is we are engaged in a process, and the process that we could say that we're engaged in is the process of inquiry and discovery. Okay, so far so good. And what else can we say about it? Well, is there a way to go when we are engaged in this effort, which we call inquiry and discovery? Is there a way to go? And I would propose that there is a way to go. And I'm going to call it something, all right? Now, you could call it whatever you like. I like to give these things that we do some kind of terminology so that we can, you know, we can be productive in our process and also in our discussions in our language. So I'm going to call this the roadmap of inquiry and discovery, or we can turn that around and say that this is the inquiry and discovery roadmap. So let's proceed on this journey of inquiry and discovery. Okay, so the first stop along the journey is we ask the question and we try to come up with an answer. What is the environment in which the solution must reside? In other words, how can we empathize with the customer? What exactly, not what the customer is doing, not what products they're selling or what services they're selling or what is their exact business model, but what's the environment in which they operate? Now, you know, if you've been following this show, you know, we have talked about this before, but it really bears repeating, and we're going to try to push this point home because it's really important. And a lot of efforts end up in failure because we don't really, it's not that we're good problem solvers, we are, but we don't really understand in many cases, or we don't spend enough time in many cases on the environment, the environmental issues. What is the environment in which the customer operates? And we can clarify the environment. We can give the environment some level of characteristics or what we call defining characteristics. What's the defining characteristics of the environment? Okay, so with respect to that, we have two choices. So the first decision node in our journey is this. Is the environment in which the customer operates and in which the solution will reside, is it a normal environment or is it a complex environment? Okay, and to make things as clear as possible here, let me say that a normal environment is one in which complexity does not occur typically, and in one in which it's fairly linear and straightforward. It's not confusing and it is not complex. All right, so that's a normal environment. Complex environment is in fact complex. Now, the word complex or complexity, that actually does have a formal description. So I know we tend to use that in a general sense. All right. And I suppose that's okay, but realize that complex and complexity or things that are complex, that actually does have a formal definition. And it has its own body of knowledge, which is called complexity theory. And, you know, I've talked about this before. And this is particularly important because things that we do in a normal environment are not necessarily the things that we want to do in a complex environment. And so why is that? That's a great question, okay? And we need to ask ourselves that as we go along, sort of like checking our own thinking process, our own critical thinking as we go through this step by step. A complex world or things that are complex or a complex environment, and a complex environment, by the way, embraces three things or two other things. I guess I could say it both ways. So a complex environment also embraces, well, it could represent an environment that is complex. It also could represent a situation that has occurred within the environment, and that is complex. So the environment is complex, and the situation that we have encountered is complex. It also could be a thing within the environment. A thing would be an object. It's another way of saying it. Some mechanism. Let's call it a complex. So a mechanism could be complex too. Some structural entity, if you will. And that could be complex. All three can be complex. So we could have a complex environment. We have encountered a complex situation, and we are employing a complex mechanism. So all three could be complex. And so that's pretty important, because if we don't understand that in a coherent way, we are liable to make serious mistakes. So the big thing, and the first thing that we do, is we ask ourselves, what is the environment in which this solution that we are trying to come up with will reside in? And what is the customer, how does the customer deal with such an environment? What do they do? Are they aware of it? And so forth and so on. Okay, so that's the first question we ask ourselves. The second one is probably equally as important. I think they all are, frankly, but this one is pretty important too. What is the kind of activities that the customer is involved in? The customer performs certain activities. What are they in terms of their general characteristics? In other words, is the customer involved in just casual activities, or is the customer involved in purposeful activities? Now, most design efforts sort of focus on digital mobile devices, and we're kind of assuming that the customer is an individual that is engaged in some aspect of living, if you will. That is often not really a good way to think about it. You know, even if these are personal devices that the customer is using, it could be hardware or software. Often the customer is not just out there in the casual way, but is involved in some kind of purposeful activities. Anyway, so what is the customer doing? And what kind of activities are they pursuing in terms of, again, well, we're going to look at it in terms of their overarching characteristics. Are they casual activities, or are they purposeful? And so we sort of, well, we have to make that call. I have to call it exactly how it is, so that we can further understand the environment and come up with a viable solution to the problem that exists. Okay, so after that, item three is, how well organized are the purposeful activities? So if the customer is involved in purposeful activities, are they moderately organized, or are they highly organized? And again, that's a pretty important question to ask and to find an answer to, is how well organized are these purposeful activities, if in fact the customer is involved in a purposeful activity. If the customer is involved in an activity that's highly organized, and let me give you some examples, all right? Some examples would be flying a military or a commercial airplane, or conducting air operations. That's a purposeful activity. Or conducting logistic operations. That's a purposeful activity. Logistic operations could be, you know, something like Amazon or UPS or FedEx or one of the big distributors, but also many, many others. Operating on an oil platform or an oil rig or an oil well, that's a purposeful activity. Involved in some military operation, that's a purposeful activity, and that is highly organized. Many of the activities that we do in this modern industrial world of ours is, in fact, purposeful activities that's highly organized. And so that's particularly important. If we need to understand that, if we don't understand that, we are liable to present to the customer a technologically superior solution or thing that doesn't really fit well within their working environment, because they might overload, cause a high workload, or cause additional difficulties or perceptual challenges. All right, so that's the third one. So as we proceed along our roadmap here, the fourth item is what we call operational concerns. Now, typically, a problem has arose. I'm sorry, did I say that word right? I don't think I did. So a problem has occurred, all right, or we think maybe a problem exists within the world of the customer, right? How did the problem come to be? And here we can list what are the operational concerns. What are we dealing with? A changing operational environment, right? And so, like, getting a little bit more specific here, we're going to talk about, can we identify an occurrence? If something has occurred, okay, that's great. Now we can go a bit further. We can say, okay, we have detected an occurrence. Is it trivial or non-trivial? If the occurrence is trivial, then we press on to another area of inquiry. If it is non-trivial, then we're on to something here. And we're on to something here that is really big time. And this is particularly important in this problem-solving endeavor. If the occurrence is non-trivial, does it rise to the level of an event? And typically, a non-trivial occurrence will rise to the level of event. There are some selection criteria, and I'm not going to get into them right now. Maybe later on in another show we can deal with that. It gets a little bit on the technical side. I don't want to get overly technical in our discussion here. But if it does rise to the level of event, there's one other thing that we need to consider with respect to this discovery process. Is the event that we have detected or that we think is probably has occurred, is the event normal or is it mission critical? So if it's just an event, okay, and it might generate a problem that we can sort of solve in a non-urgent way, but if it is a mission critical event, then that takes on a certain measure of urgency. And so we want to consider that very, very seriously. And that becomes a major item of discussion with our customer. If it is, in fact, mission critical, and if it is mission critical, then we need to clearly understand exactly what it is. Okay, so we are coming up close to the midway point in our show. So I need to wrap this up, this part one, because part two is going to be a continuing discussion of the world of Jordan Peterson, which is very, very important in today's world, and it's something that ought to be discussed. So it's critical news that's behind the headlines, if you will, Not a lot of people are taking this on, but I do think it is important that we do so, because that's the whole purpose of Throttle Up. Okay, so let me summarize where we've gone so far. All right, so we're dealing with inquiry and discovery, the inquiry and discovery roadmap. So the first thing that we have talked about is the environment. What is the environment in which the customer operates? That's important. Item two, what are the activities? Not specifically, but generally, what are the activities? Is the customer involved in activities? And I'm assuming it is, because it's in the business of doing business, and so there's some kind of activity going on. Are these casual or purposeful activities? If they are purposeful activities, then we continue in our train of thought. The next thing that we encounter is occurrences. Has something occurred with respect to the customer, with respect to the environment, with respect to something that the customer needs to know about, or that the customer is involved in? These have occurrences happened. In other words, what are the changing operational conditions? If the current occurrences are non-trivial, then we press on and we figure out what are the events, what are the mission critical events, and what events in the event set, or in what are the mission critical events in this set of events that have triggered the problem. So we have a triggering mechanism. What has triggered, or what has piqued our interest, if you will? What has triggered the problem? What has caused the problem to become manifest? What has gained our attention? What thing has occurred? What signal have we detected that leads us to believe that, in fact, there is a problem? Not the problem now, but what was the triggering mechanism? What triggered our attention? What hooked our attention, so to speak? And that's particularly important. A lot of people sort of like dive right into the problem without getting prepared to engage in this this critical cognitive process, which we call complex problem solving. And so we really sort of like have to set the stage for a good solution to emerge. If we don't set the stage properly and get all of our ducks in a row, the chances of us coming up with a viable solution to the problem is diminished. And so we sort of like have to set the stage. And so we're going to do that. Once we have figured out what the problem is and we have clarified the problem by creating a problem definition, formal problem definition, then we start generating solutions. Here we brainstorm, and I'm not going to get into that solution generation process. We're running out of time here, but We will cover that in future shows. Particularly important, I think, once we understand that the ability to come up with a solution to a complex problem is not something that we do on a casual or even an ad hoc basis. We have to engage what we call analytic reasoning. And analytic reasoning is a specific way to go about organize our cognitive processes so that we can solve complex problems. All right, so that's kind of an interesting aspect of future shows. I think it's going to be pretty exciting as we get into that, and we will. So that wraps up part one, and let us press on to part two. Welcome back to part two of Throttle Up for this week. Part two is our storyboard, and in our storyboard this week, we're going to continue our discussion that we started, I think it was last week, we started our discussion of Jordan Peterson. So this is the world of Jordan Peterson. And he has, well, he has came upon the, or sort of has been catapulted to the big time, if you will. He's now one of the more recognized philosophers and psychiatrists or psychologists. He's a trained psychologist. I think so. Anyway, so he has a book. Got lots of videos that you can pull up on YouTube. And our discussion this week is something that he brings up in his discussions almost on a regular basis. And I thought we ought to spend some quality time on one of the aspects of his rather remarkable discussions that he has, particularly on his videos, but also in his book. His book is called The 12 Rules of Life. I think it's number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list, number 1 on Amazon. And I've read it, and I would highly recommend it if Jordan asked me what I thought of it from a personal standpoint and as a fellow author, I would say it's a great book. I would have preferred that it be a bit shorter, and that's my preference, all right? And I think that's the preference of a lot of people. I know when I was finishing work on my first book some years ago, I was talking to my granddaughter about it, and she asked me, "Grandpa, can you read it in a weekend?" And I said, "Yeah, I kept it short enough that you could read it over a weekend." And she says, "That's perfect, because most college students are not going to read anything that they can't finish over a weekend." And so my preference is to keep it as short and sweet as possible and get the key points out so that people can use that. And also, it's also, I think, useful to put things in the context of a story. And we try to do that. I try to do that in my books and videos that I have out there, as well as this radio show, and soon to be podcast. Well, my understanding is that we're going to have that podcast up and running this week. I think so. I think I've got some word. Well, I got some word from my technical people, and they have. I think they've done everything necessary, but. Once it's up and running, I'll let everybody know how to get to it, how to find it, and hopefully by next week we'll have that information out. Okay, so Jordan Peterson enjoys a large and growing following. He highlights, among other things, he highlights what is now being called neo-Marxism, and he uses that as an example of a growing cognitive virus that has afflicted almost all modern industrial societies. I call it intellectual nonsense. But nevertheless, he takes it on full force, and he talks about it. So I wanted to introduce and talk more about neo-Marxism and how did it come to be? In other words, from a critical thinking perspective, how did it come to be, and what should we make of it? How should we think about it? And what's going to happen if we don't deal with it effectively? All right, so let me start off by saying much of what the left, which has become radicalized in most countries in which they exist, has done recently is to shut down debate, reject mutual respect, and attempt to assume control over language and thought. Jordan Peterson has been catapulted on the world stage because he has challenged the left on every turn, and use the power of objective reason. This is, by the way, parenthetically, another form of critical thinking, to highlight the idiocy of their arguments. Almost all of their arguments are nothing more than intellectual nonsense. Those are my terms. But with one overriding distinction, they all are designed to evoke an emotional response, notwithstanding the fact that they are logically incoherent and based often on a false premise, being offered to ultimately justify an agenda based on some form of collectivism. From a critical thinking standpoint, where did collectivism come from? Where did earthbound utopianism come from? And where did the modern version of utopianism, that is neo-Marxism, come from? All right, so in other words, what's the second paragraph here in my discussion is the antecedents. All right, I know that's a fancy term for what has gone before. Where did they come from? All right, what were the root causes of this movement? The development of neo-Marxism came about after a result of several unexpected situations and occurrences that were perplexing to those who supported Marxist theory. One, why did socialists and social democrats, or social democratic political parties, not band together against hyper-nationalism manifested just before the beginning of World War I? In other words, why did transnational socialist solidarity not occur? Now, having said that, I will say that the movement wanted it to occur transnationally. It did want it to occur, but it didn't. Why not? Why did no large-scale worker revolution occur throughout Europe? As predicted, especially after the communists took power in Russia in 1917. Socialists and social democratic parties in Europe were essentially all communists, with some minor differences from country to country. Neo-Marxism attempts to update Marxism for modern times, but all forms of Marxism and communism share the following. They emphasize that capitalism cannot be reformed, but must be overthrown or replaced with a new form, emphasizing the eradication of private property. That's what they believe. I know, it's rather frightening, but they believe that. Two, human existence can be characterized as essentially a struggle between classes. Item three, dictatorship of the non-property owners is the only way to bring about a more just society and thus usher in utopia. Now, you notice right up front that they're having trouble with staying coherent, and their coherency is now in trouble. Dictatorship and utopia don't go together. But that's sort of like, that's how they do things. They do things in a way that that sort of like defies all rules of logic. But nevertheless, they do it. So we could say that the whole philosophical basis of neo-Marxism is illogical. Okay, I would agree with that. So let me continue. By the turn of the century and before World War I, the largest communist party was in Germany and was called the Social Democratic Party. The German Social Democratic Party was the largest communist, a.k.a. Marxist party in Europe, because this new type of party and the Vanguard Party, the Red October 17 revolt, occurred after that, and that was part and parcel of, or was aided and abetted by the German Social Democratic Party. And they went on to, particularly in Russia, they went on to, after the Red October Revolt in 1917, to eliminate all other parties. And Communist Party was, this is really fascinating. The Communist Party in Russia was modeled after Germany's war socialism initiative that they put in place during World War One. So I guess you could say that Marxism and the follow-on neo-Marxism had their roots in the World War One and the aftermath of World War One. Now, they believe that the Bolsheviks, which is a term for the leadership, I guess, of the communist movement, they believe that there was an impending worldwide revolution that's going to happen, and to foster that in 1919, the communists in Russia, they tried to export communism globally, and they formed organizations. The acronym that they used was Comintern. They tried to create organizations worldwide and bring about a worldwide workers' revolution against capitalism. So let me continue here and see if we can finish this. If we can't, then we'll continue next week. So the Russian style Marxism, aka communism, from the time of Lenin, about 1917 onward, is characterized as a form of government that, while asserting a more harmonious, just, and collaborative society, brought about by the eradication of private property and its attendant evils, increasingly became tyrannical, intolerant of competitive ideas, and subjugated its people through abject fear. Tens of millions of Russians were either imprisoned, killed, or both, all because they either perceived or were actually posed a threat to the established communist order or to the communist establishment. This reign of terror with respect to a society turning against itself with such brutality saw no equal in the history of mankind. And that's pretty much a direct quote from Jordan Peterson, as well as many others. Any intelligent observer in history has got to conclude that this was the bloodiest thing that has occurred in the history of mankind, the bloodiest movement, if you will. It's just astounding and appalling of how much carnage and suffering and death occurred in the name of utopianism or Marxism, or now we call it neo-Marxism. Understanding communism from a critical thinking perspective, the following items are considered. One, communism, aka Marxism, as an implementable idea, is a child of history and could not have been successful without the sentiments, beliefs, and horrible economic conditions that existed as a result of World War One, the Great War. So we could say with some measure of assurance that communism is a end product of the horrible situation that occurred during the immediate aftermath of World War One. Without World War One, it is almost impossible to imagine that communism would ever have taken hold among any nations in the world, particularly any nations in that were considered to be modern industrial societies. Communism, this is item two, communism fancied itself as yet another historically significant revolution along the lines of the French Revolution and the American Revolution. The communist leadership misunderstood the American Revolution because it was the result of external colonial powers, not an internal class struggle. So they misunderstood, as you would expect. They sort of see the world through their own distorted lens that they use, which is the lens of collectivism, and so they entirely misunderstood the American Revolution. Communism was convinced that the Russian October Revolution was a harbinger of things to come, namely, that other European countries would do the same thing, and as a result, country after country would fall to communism. This did, in fact, not occur, to the great consternation of the communist leadership in Russia. Once class distinctions were eradicated due to a more equitable redistribution of wealth, a working class utopia would quickly be realized. This was their belief system. Their belief system faltered. They believed something that actually did not occur and was not going to occur in any foreseeable future within the sphere of influence that we call Europe. Communism as a movement and a set of ideas can be decomposed into two broad categories. Number one, how to bring about a communist state through revolutionary tactics. And that they did particularly well in Russia, although I do think that there were circumstances there that were kind of unique, and they were more or less lucky, or they capitalized, or they took advantage of certain opportunities that were fairly unique to that particular time and place. Item two is how to hold on to power once communism has been installed. And this is where the reign of terror occurs. The communists, once they have seized the reins of power of a faltering country and its faltering economy, to maintain that power requires such levels of brutality that it defies imagination. That's the case. Now, engineering a revolution is probably communists' greatest challenge. Here, all the propaganda forces at the disposal of the country are needed. Adroit use of all channels of communication is essential in order to win over a significant number of citizens that will permit an overthrow. The communist takeover of Russia, the first time Marxism became a global force to contend with, occurred at the apex of three forces. One, World War I. Second force, widespread famine. And the third force, government instability. Of course, those two go hand in glove. It is unlikely that communist-style internally focused revolutions are possible without an almost total breakdown of the civil society or civil order prior to the arrival of the communists. Okay, so I'm going to touch on one last chapter of this discussion of neo-Marxism for at least for this week, and then we'll press on with any further discussions about this next week. Right now, we'll take a short break and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Trottle Up. Now, we're going to finish our discussions, at least for this week, on neo-Marxism. And the way we'll end it is this section is called Stalin and the Reign of Terror. Now, if communism is so great, why does it result in such brutality as expressed in the Stalin Reign of Terror? And this was the saddest chapter in all of human history, the utter brutality and evil of this regime was so astounding as to leave one completely breathless. It is something that is beyond belief. And why anybody would think today that any form of collectivism, any form of Marxism or neo-Marxism is suitable as an idea, is worthy of discussion. I don't know why anybody would think that after knowing the lessons of history with respect to Stalin and the Reign of Terror. Now, after Lenin's death in about 1924, Stalin assumed supreme power of Russia communists and began in earnest a reign of terror, which had roughly the following objectives. One, a massive forced labor to build showcase projects intended to promote the idea of a communist state, modernizing and surpassing all other capitalist countries. Two, dislocation and elimination of those resisting the collectivization of all farms and agriculture. Item three, party purges. This occurred on a regular basis, and this was really chilling. Party purges occurring constantly to purify the ideological status of the communist movement. Four, organized famines. I know that's hard to believe. Organized famines intended at the subjugation of groups of people. Item five, massive concentration camps housing at its peak over 2.5 million citizens intended to sow fear or abject fear amongst the population at large. Item six, systematic purges where, for example, between 1936 and 1938, 600,000 Russians were executed. Not making that up. That is stunning. 600,000 Russians were executed through purges. And remember, purges were done based upon time, not based upon threat. Item seven, quotas. Quotas of the number of people to be arrested by the secret police was in fact established. Okay, so that completes our discussion for this week on Throttle Up, and we are at the end of another show. I wanted to present this because I think it is a disturbing chapter in human history. We need to understand the roots of neo-Marxism, which is now raising its ugly head again, as Jordan Peterson has pointed out. We need to understand it. We need to understand it from a historical and critical thinking perspective so that we can deal with it effectively. All right. So I'm at the end of another Throttle Up. Enjoy being here. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Red State Talk Radio, for this opportunity. And thank you, all of you veterans out there. Thank you for your service. Thank you, the members, the family members of the veterans. Thank you for helping this country. Thank all of you on active duty, in the Guard, in Reserve. Thank you for serving.